Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Back to School with Maz Jobrani. Very excited. Today I've got author Michael Mechanic on with us. He's written a book called Jackpot, How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All. He's going to talk to us, first of all, about how being wealthy is not that great, how they're rich and sad. I know, kind of makes you happy, doesn't it? Secondly, he's going to tell us how we can fix the income gap and bridge that gap so there's better wealth disbursement, and we can all get more equal when it comes to wealth. And lastly, he's here today to tell us that we should have bought Bitcoin a long time ago. It's too late. It's too late. I'm calling my financial advisor and firing him right after this. All of that and more on Back to School with Maz Jobrani.
Maz Jobrani.
Hey.
Jobrani Maz. Oh, Maz Jobrani.
Hey, Jobrani.
Mazzy, Mazzy, oh, Maz.
Hey.
I got a podcast, oh,
Back to School, yeah.
Hey guys, I am super excited because we got a sponsor, HelloFresh. Don't know if you've heard of them. HelloFresh is America's number one meal kit, and they're going to give you free meals because you listen to my podcast. That's right. So all you got to do is you got to go to HelloFresh.com/12school, the number 12, the word school, and you enter in the promo code 12 school, they're going to send you 12 free meals. It's amazing. HelloFresh.com/12school. I tried it. It's delicious. They send you the ingredients. You prepare it in a short time. You're going to love it. Try it out. It's free. What do you got to lose? Do it. Hey guys, Maz Jobrani here. Excited today to talk about the wealth gap here with my sidekick, Tehran. Tehran, are you wealthy?
No. No, most people aren't. I'm part of the 99% of the world that is not.
What is going on with, I mean, we have friends that are really wealthy. Do you have friends that are wealthy that you say, oh, this person is handling their wealth well? And also, do you have friends that you say, wow, this person is just not handling it well?
Most of my friends, I have a lot of rich friends. I have a few wealthy friends. And I've only have one friend who's not handling their wealth very well. Other than that, they're pretty well adjusted. They may be far removed from the problems of the everyday person. However, they're pretty well adjusted, and that's just how their life is.
So that friend of yours who's not handling their wealth well, do you think it's because of the wealth, or do they have other issues that they would have had regardless of the wealth?
Actually, that friend is you, Maz. That friend is you. That friend is not handling it well. You're doing all these things like getting a house, having a family. We should have been partying right now, Maz. We should have been partying.
You are so right, Tehran. You are so right. I've been misspending.
You got a dog? You got a dog? Like, more responsibility? What were you thinking?
I think that in my mind, I live like a rich person, but then in reality, I'm like, oh no, another bill. And I go, I gotta find a way to live like a non-rich person. But no, you know, listen, I have friends, we've seen it all. Like, for the most part, you're right. The people that I know that are really rich, most of them are pretty nice, and they work hard, especially in our community. I think a lot of people, it's all about working hard. But once in a while you run into somebody, you go, gosh, this money's not helping this person at all. You know, usually it is the child of a rich person who has just been handed everything. I remember this specifically, moving to LA and seeing the parents, a lot of Persian parents would buy their kids their first car. And the first car out the gate was a brand new Mercedes. And I was like, no, not a good thing. No. Give them the used Honda. You know, don't do that. And I think it just sets the wrong precedence.
Yeah.
You know,
make them earn it. There's something to earning. There's something to work ethic. And it's actually something, for the most part, in immigrant families, they do teach their kids even when it comes to money, for the most part. Now, there is, of course, the super wealthy in other nations who just don't do anything. But I feel that Persian kids still do chores and still do work and still put away their own dishes and things like this. Things I've seen you teach your kids to do.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, I actually remember as a kid, you know, we were pretty well off, but I started getting jobs. I had a paper route when I was, 10, 12 years old. Best thing that ever happened to me. I was working at a pizza place. I used to deliver Domino's. I've done it all. You name it, I've done it. But it was the best thing. And I tell my wife all the time, and I'll tell any parent listening to this, get your kids to do summer jobs or volunteer somewhere. That's the most important thing, because then if they were to be successful financially, they'll know how to handle it.
Exactly.
But today you guys are going to be talking to, we're going to be talking to Michael Mechanic, the author of Jackpot. It's a great book. It's very interesting. The stories are interesting. He tells a story right away about this guy who invested like, I don't know, 30 grand or something for Amazon back in the day. He didn't even know what it was. Some guy named Jeff was a friend of a friend's. And you go, this guy's smart. Here's 30 grand. That's, you know, the guy wasn't that rich. He goes, here's 30 grand. And he goes on his honeymoon. And all of a sudden he gets a call. They're like, oh, that stock that you invested in is worth $50 million. Like, what? So it's an interesting book. I want you guys to pick it up. Tehran, where do people find you?
At I am Tehran all across the board and in the homeless welfare line. F my L.
Do me a favor. Tell your friends about this show. We're trying to blow this show up so that we can be super rich and drive to the studio in a Bentley. Currently, I just walk over and I've got this cheap ass poster that was given to me for free. And that's my little vanity light that costs like 30 bucks on Amazon. Help us upgrade. Tell your friends about the show. Spread the word. Enjoy it. And come see us live. The touring's going to start soon. And check out my special Pandemic Warrior, which is on Peacock. I'm across the board at Maz Jobrani. We appreciate all your support. Let's go talk to Michael Mechanic on Back to School with Maz Jobrani.
Back to school. Yeah.
Michael Mechanic, thank you for joining us over here. Author of Jackpot. Right there, your book coming out April 13th, editor at Mother Jones. This is How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All. You could have just talked to Tehran, you know, he's a super rich guy. So
is he?
Bitcoin, what NFTs, is... crypto, no. You know, things that don't exist. I do all that.
Michael,
I missed that boat.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I want to learn about that too. So let's start with a question from my son, Dara. When I told him you wrote this book, had him check it out. And here is question to Michael Mechanic.
Hi, Mr. McKinnon. I have a question for you. Would you want to be a billionaire?
No.
No?
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is, you think like, God, I could do so many things for so many people if I had $1 billion. And life would be super fun. That's sort of what we think, you know, and I would just have complete freedom. And, you know, there's in some way that's right. But in other ways, your life becomes just chaotic and harried. And you have to think about your money all the time, or you will think about your money all the time. We sort of fantasize that money will free us, but in a way it's a cage, you know, because you're thinking about, oh, I got to grow this, or I got to maintain it, and everyone's going to come at me and try to get a piece of it. People try to take advantage of you. They want you to invest in this shoddy business deal over here, and you don't have time to investigate. So you got to hire someone to investigate, and then you got to hire someone to investigate the guy who's hiring, that you're hiring to investigate the deal to make sure he's legit. I mean, it can be a real time suck.
You interview a lot of people. This is your first book. You interviewed a lot of people that are very wealthy, and you tell some stories in a very entertaining way. Tell us of one person that comes to mind that talked to you like this, where they said, look, I am super rich, but God, I wish I, you know, I there was one thing where you said there was a lady who was looking out at the beach and people were barbecuing, and she started crying because she goes, oh my God, I wish I could just do that. So tell us a story of someone that comes to mind specifically that had the, was a little sad about being a billionaire or multi-millionaire.
Yeah, well, there's a woman in the book that I call Martha. She's actually an inheritor. And she didn't really know much about it. During her childhood, she knew she had a very wealthy grandfather who had started a big financial company. But, you know, they lived kind of upper middle class, not flashy. Her parents didn't talk about it. Nobody talked about money. They kind of knew not to ask questions about it because it was just not something you did in that family. You didn't get into how much money does granddad have, you know. And so then she it's time for her to go to college, and they set up this fund for her. Her mom sets up this fund that says it's going to your college fund, and you can draw tuition and so forth from there. And so they put some holdings from the company, and so she has this fund, and you know, dividend. She didn't know anything about where the money was coming from exactly, but you know, it was modest at first, and it paid for her college, and so she would just pay all her expenses out of this. And then sort of as she gets older, and nobody had ever talked about this in the family, that this was going to happen. She gets older, she's in her 20s, she gets out of college, she goes to grad school, she's working, doing things, she becomes a novelist, and she's not making much money as a novelist, but like barely enough, but she has some money in her account that's sort of backstopping her so she can write her books. She's probably getting $10,000 or $20,000 advances on her books. Like, you can't live on that, right? So in her like 30s, she, you know, the quarterly reports are coming in from the account, right? And it starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And at some point, you know, it's up to like $1 million and it's starting to grow like $200,000 a year. I mean, that's a big income for somebody who's, you know. And then all of a sudden, like 2001, 2002, something changes with the dividends, and millions of dollars are pouring into this account per year. All of a sudden, she's making millions of dollars. She's shoving the things in a drawer and kind of freaking out because she has this life as an author. She has regular friends. She's never thought of herself as like a rich person. Mm. And all of a sudden, she's really rich. Mm. And it kept accumulating. And also, so she had just gotten engaged to be married at that point. And
did they break up? Did they break up? What's, well, Martha's last name? Can I find her on Instagram?
See, that's the thing, right? You know, you actually become a target, especially if you're a woman.
Well, not a target. Love interest. There's a difference.
Yeah, well, love it.
Thank you.
It depends. So her ex-husband, now ex-husband, I mean, that it was really the money that screwed things up. He, you know, she says, he didn't marry me for the money, but he took like a ridiculous interest in the money. He wanted to know more than I knew. And he would like listen in on family calls, and he was prodding her, learn more, find out more about this, ask questions, you know. And I mean, there's some reason to that, but she just felt it was sort of unhealthy the way he was obsessed with it. And he also wanted them to do private jets and things like that. And she's like, I don't want to do private jets. She's like, I don't want to be one of those people, right? Mm. And so then all this sort of came up in her social relationships later. You know, she's hanging out with her friends and they're kvetching about, oh, you know, can we afford this? And, oh, my husband wants to retire. I don't know if we can swing it. Or, you know, my kids, they got into this school, but I don't know if we can afford the tuition. And she's just sitting there. She's like the fourth wheel, kind of going, I can't relate to any of this.
So it's almost like her personality had changed, because she went from this struggling novelist to finding out, oh my God, I have a lot of money. So I guess my question to you is, did you run into anybody, you know, you hear all the time about Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, who gave away a ton of their wealth. And they said, we're giving it to this foundation, that foundation, going to do good.
Tax shelters are amazing.
Well, that's what my question is. Are they doing good? And if not them, has anyone been able to navigate this world of being wealthy and really kind of, because your book says how the super rich really live and how their wealth harms us all. Can you give us examples of super rich who have not harmed us, but bettered the world somehow?
Well, I mean, I think you can make a good argument for a guy like Bill Gates, right, who has spent a ton of money. But, you know, one thing you've got to realize, and Mackenzie Scott, Jeff Bezos's ex, mm-hmm. who just in the last year has given away about $8 billion,
wow.
All for like social justice, leveling the playing field, reducing inequality, and helping people that are suffering from the pandemic. And she really did her homework and found groups that are effective, and she's just pouring money out to them. And she didn't do this by starting a big foundation with a lot of infrastructure and saying this foundation is going to last forever, like these can, because the foundation is only required to give out 5% of its money, right? Mm-hmm. They have these huge endowments. The stock market's growing 20, 30% a year, and they hand out 5%, and that includes overhead. Mm-hmm. So you can just have these foundations that, they take a big tax break, so we're paying for that. They're subsidized. And then they can last forever, and they can take their directors on expensive junkets and charge that to the 5%, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, that's harmful to the tax base that pays for a lot of things that are really important. But what I was going to say about even, you know, Mackenzie Scott and Bill Gates, who has done great things that probably, you know, governments haven't gotten around to doing. I mean, there's a role for philanthropy, but Bill Gates is probably wealthier than he's ever been. He's not given away 90% of his wealth. He's given away a tiny proportion of it so far. And the giving pledge, which is sort of this praiseworthy thing, it's, you know, you pledge to give away a majority of your wealth in life and death. It used to be they try to encourage you to do it while you're alive, which is the ideal, but they kind of changed it. So yeah, you can do it in your estate. But most of the people who are in the giving pledge list are richer now than they were when they signed that thing, because their wealth is accumulating so fast. And it's accumulating because the tax policies we have in place favor wealth over the working man, you know?
So let me ask you a question. This is a question that a lot of my right-leaning, fiscally Republican friends will ask. What's the harm in working hard and earning more money? And should we be trying to make it so that those people can earn less money? Or is it to teach everyone else to be able to earn more money? Or is the problem that it's not about the earning the money, it's about the rules that have been put into place to help those who earn their money keep their money in these loophole-y ways where everyone else, like Warren Buffett famously said, my secretary pays more taxes than I do, and I'm Warren Buffett.
Yeah, well, I think there you got to define what you mean by earn, right? So if I have, you know, if I inherited 100 grand from my daddy and I can put that in some stock or some investment, and that thing multiplies tenfold over a decade, then that money, the gains that I got from it, if I sell that stock, right now it's like a 20% tax on that. If I had gone to work and worked my butt off and earned that money, I'd be paying, you know, right now 37% on the highest part of that. So we're basically favoring people that already have money, capital to invest, over people who are working hard. And, you know, some of these people do work very hard. I mean, company founders, they work their butts off. But as one guy in the book said, this guy, Jerry Fidler, he was the CEO of a tech company that sold to Intel later. So, you know, he's pretty loaded. But he said, I work 100-hour weeks. He said, but my cleaning woman works harder than I do now, and she makes nothing, you know? So he said, hard work is necessary, but not sufficient. And I think that's right.
And are the taxes this way simply because the people who had the money were able to lobby to say, look, tax my stocks this way? I mean, why wouldn't the solution just be to say, okay, let's everyone just tax at 30%, whatever that is, income earned as well as stock income, just tax them both the same. Why are they different?
Well, they are different because the business community and wealthy people have been able to lobby Congress to fix the laws this way. And they say, oh, well, it's important. It's good. It's like trickle down. It's like we want to encourage investment, and then the investment's going to go into businesses and create jobs and so forth. So there's this argument that investment is somehow, you know, the gains should be taxed at a lower rate to encourage this. But it's like, where else are they going to put their money? I mean, we're talking about people with massive surplus, and they've got to invest it somewhere. You tax them more on the gains, they're still going to invest in those things. Did I answer your question?
You know, I'm trying to figure out how we got here is the question, basically. Like, how did we, you know, what was it, Reagan? Was it the, like you said, trickle down? When were things working out where the billionaires weren't screwing everybody over?
Well, there was a sort of a between the Gilded Age of the 20s when they started putting some taxes in place. And sort of in through the 40s, 50s, 60s, post-war, things were closer as far as the income and wage disparities between rich and poor. Once you hit the mid 80s with the, there were two Reagan tax cuts, I think in 81 and 86, if I'm remembering right. And between the two of them was the biggest tax cut for the wealthy, I think in history, because down in the Gilded Age, there were no taxes on the wealthy except for land taxes, right? So that's when you start seeing the curves diverge, where the 1% wealth is just going up and up and up, and the 10% wealth is going up a little bit, and the, you know, the rest of us are just stagnant. Hmm. You saw this great divergence, and it's just continued all the way up till now. And the pandemic has probably made things considerably worse.
So it really can be drawn to tax policies.
Right.
Tehran, what's your question for Mike?
Well, actually, my question is, why are there so many billionaires in the world now?
Well, that's part of just what we were talking about, because, you know, it takes money to make money is the old adage, right? And that's just become more and more true. So you have just people who have a lot of money to invest, they call it dry powder, just cashing it in a big way. Whereas, I mean, that's a very small group at the very top, but their wealth is accelerating away from the pack. So now you have this sort of explosion. I mean, there's a company called WealthX who studies this stuff. They count 788 billionaires, and it's up like 15% from a few years ago. There's really been this massive expansion of what we call the ultra wealthy people with 30 million and up, and also up to the billionaire level.
You mean 788 billionaires in the U.S.
In the
alone.
United States, right? Yeah.
And you say that it affects some of the people who get held back most are women and people of color. Can you explain that?
Well, I'm talking about as far as people who are talented and educated and want to achieve high positions. I mean, it's a bit different for women and Black Americans, but Black Americans basically since slavery have had all these official policies in place that really, when you think about it, are obstacles to wealth. They're trying to eliminate, you know, it's like white people trying to eliminate economic competition. You know, it started with the Black codes and the Jim Crow laws and so forth, the racial housing covenants. You know, you can't live here. Oh, all of a sudden we got the Homestead Acts, which gave, you know, parcels of land to white homesteaders. 1.2 million white families got 160 acre parcels of land. It was the biggest wealth transfer from public to private in the history of the United States. And something like 5,000 Black families were able to get land in this deal. And if you look at, I had this research to do the calculations for me, a quarter of white adults today are descendants of those people. Mm. So everybody's like, oh, I'm self-made. It's like, well, what about your great, great, great granddaddy got this land? And then you got a federally backed home loan because, you know, that was given to whites and not Blacks. And maybe your dad or your granddad was a beneficiary of the GI Bill, which also was almost entirely benefited white people. So it's essentially the government has sort of propped up white wealth and ignored Black wealth or held it down. And it's just both the government policies and like just racism in society.
And also it's not great.
Now when you look, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's not great, great, great granddad. It's literally just great granddad. So when the Homestead Act happens in 1862, we think of it as a very long time ago, but in a generation speaking, it's only four generations removed from us. Four generations is not a long, you know, people know their great grandmothers. Right. And so it's just four generations removed where
it's
we
really
are.
It's really close, yeah.
So when you end up with like, let's say a senator right now who's votes for the tax cut that they say is gonna cost whatever, $2 trillion. And then they turn around, they don't vote for the pandemic relief bill, the stimulus bill that just passed. Are these people, in your opinion, in your research, are they knowingly saying, I want to keep people that are lower class down, and I want to give a break to those who are paying for my campaign and for paying for me being a senator? Or are they, do they believe in kind of a hands-off approach of government, except in that case where they said, okay, government's going to give my people a tax break? Like, how is it that as objective human beings, we can't all look at this and say, oh, a stronger middle class is better for everybody, and people don't need to be $50 billion worth? What's going on in their minds?
Well, you know, I can't read their minds, but I would say it's not like they sit around and they're evil people and they say, oh, let's hold the poor down, right? They're doing what they think is in their self-interest and the self-interest of the people who give them money. They're not going out because they necessarily want to hurt people, but they just want to do favors for the people who essentially have all the wealth and power already. It's really a pursuance of self-interest. And when you have money to give to politicians, they pay attention to you. And that's a fact. And in fact, politicians, like most of the people in Congress, are fairly wealthy. They're much wealthier than the median American. And that has an impact on the policies they put forth. In fact, it's interesting because there's been research done on this. It was a little while back, but they found that Republicans voted the same way no matter what, you know, because they were just sort of, the Republicans were always going to vote against the thing that reduces inequality, economic inequality. But the Democrats, the rich Democrats, were less likely to support bills that reduced inequality than poor Democrats were.
So even the Democrats are guilty of voting for their own self-interest in terms of maintaining their wealth. So really the solution would be to get a lot more people like a Ralph Nader, people who aren't wealthy, into politics and have them vote for their self-interest.
I think that's right. And the thing is, it's really hard to get people. There's a lot of talented people who will never run for office because they don't have this network of connections already in place. You know, when you're from a rich family or you know a lot of wealthy people, or maybe your parents are friends with wealthy, you have this sort of set of connections by which that you can call on people to help you and make phone calls for you and give you money and support your run for whatever office. And if you're from like a lower middle class background, even if you're a great leader, it's really hard to break through that lack of connections.
I kind of get this picture of all these rich people sitting around and they're like, I'm rich, I got nothing to do, I'll just run for Senate. They go, all right, just go run for Senate. And then it's like, okay, now I'm in and now I'll give my uncle a tax break. And
that's not it. Actually, it's interesting. If you actually look at the background of most senators, they come from a political family. So they actually have this, they have a generational understanding of politics and they come from that background. So while Ralph Nader is not super rich, I think he's worth like $10 million. Mark Warner, who's the Democratic senator from Virginia, is worth $250 million. And it comes from this background where, and often votes to help his friends. It just depends. As a Democrat, it just depends.
So Mike, with stats like this, how do we get out of this? How do we turn this thing around and help the common man and woman?
Well, actually, with Biden's election and people like Bernie Sanders and AOC out there and Elizabeth Warren calling for changes, we're seeing a lot of proposals that could help go in that direction if they can get through. And that's a big question. I mean, HR 1, the voting rights bill, we think about it as a voting rights bill, but it's also a big campaign reform bill. Campaign reform, I interviewed Russ Feingold, who was part of the big McCain-Feingold campaign finance legislation, which got completely gutted by the courts. It doesn't exist hardly anymore. And so now you can go out and give as much, corporations can give as much money as they want to a candidate and to political parties. And it's just become like this big mass corrupt amoeba, right? So HR 1 is the Democrats' attempt to bring things back under control. and it's going to face, you know, there was a phone call that Jane Mayer of the New York Times just revealed between like the Koch family network. And they had this conference call and it was leaked. And they were so up in arms about this bill, which they knew was popular, even among a lot of conservative voters, because conservatives are sick of this too. And they're like, what are we going to do? So they decided they were going to handle it under the dome, meaning they were going to try to influence senators like Joe Manchin. So they put the pressure on a guy like that. He's a Democrat, moderate Democrat. And he can stop the thing from going through because it's such a knife's edge between of Democratic control.
And also, Maz, if you remember, when you get into politics, AOC got a huge raise when she got into politics. She went from one of us to someone who's upper middle class. She's making almost $200,000 a year now. And though she does continuously fight for us, the concept is she's clearly in that upper middle class range. A lot of political positions pay well. Remember when we found out how much council members made? And we were like, wait, how much did they make to be on the city council?
That actually, sorry, I lost my thought. Go on.
Well, that's like, my thought is when people read a book like Mike's book, Jackpot, coming out April 13th, make sure to pick it up. You can pick it up anywhere books are available. But when you read a book like that, or when you talk to Robert Reich, or you talk to some of these people who are talking about the inequalities, we all see the inequalities, we all see the disparity in wealth. At what point do these people continue to think that trickle-down economics is going to work? At what point do they say, well, we've tried 40 some odd years of trickle-down economics and the disparity continues to grow and we're losing this middle class? For me, for example, as a performer, when I go to tour, I'd like a stronger middle class because that means more tickets would be sold and more people can have spending power. So rather than having a handful of billionaires at the show. So are the politicians just short-sighted and blind to where we're headed? Are they seeing the red alarms going off and realizing we need to make some changes, or we're going to end up in a revolution, or we're going to end up in a place where, again, I think COVID is a perfect example. When someone gets it, doesn't matter where they live, it spreads and we all get it. So what do you feel is the future here, Mike? What do you feel needs to be done to get some of these people to see the light?
Well, the thing about trickle-down economics is it was always BS. And these guys know it. And they've known it for a long time. And we've given it a chance, you know, ever since it was the Reagan era. It was Jack Kemp, the former football star, who was the big supply side, which is the same as trickle-down proponent. And ever since then, you know, the conservatives worship Ronald Reagan. They're still pounding on this trickle-down thing. It doesn't work, though. The economy does not work that way. And it's been debunked a million times. And they still push it because, you know, they lie, frankly. And so we're half and half. One side is dead set on keeping things the way they are, and the other side wants change. So it's going to take some public pressure, really, a lot of public pressure. And actually, it's going to take the public to vote out some of the people who are just diehard, you know, status quo people.
And unfortunately, the public votes against its own self-interest time and time and time again, simply because the big money also has big propaganda. That's why we hear news stories. A lot of times corporations actually use propaganda against one another. The reason why the Pepsi story with Kylie Jenner blew up is because Coca-Cola paid for it. Why would it not take Pepsi out of the... On the flip side, when Pepsi came out with Coke, came out with Coke Clear, Pepsi came out with Pepsi, a clear version of Pepsi that tasted horribly, just to make sure Coke lost a share. That's how it works. It's not, I don't write the rules. It's a fact.
Well, listen, once in a while, the system works itself out. And by the time this comes out, we might have more clarity. But now Matt Getz, who supposedly, I guess, comes from a rich family, is in this scandal with the 17-year-old girl. Who knows what's going to happen there? But you might be able to get rid of Matt Getz. I don't know. I'm just saying. And I think he's one of those guys who has been
One piece. It's the system. People always say that the system's broken. The system is not broken. The system is working perfectly fine for those who created the system. It's working the way they wanted it to work. It's causing division. It's socioeconomic disparity, wealth gap, all these things, because America is not a democracy. It is an oligarchy. And the sooner that we understand that, the better we are. But who's going to blame them? That's why we need a rejackpot.
Speaking of the system, Mike, talk to me for a second about the, is it the wealth tax, which is when somebody passes away, they have to, for the money to go to their heirs, to their kids, there's a tax, correct? Could you explain that a little bit and how it works?
Well, yeah, sure. So there's a gift tax and an estate tax, and they're linked. Essentially, you have a lifetime limit on how much you can give to other people, not counting charities, during your lifetime and after death. So right now that limit is $11.7 million for an individual, or twice that for a married couple. So it means a couple can give $23.4 million to their children without paying a penny of federal tax. And a lot of wealthy people want to do more than that, amazingly, because that's a lot of money to give your kids. It could actually screw them up pretty bad. But if you want to leave $1 billion to your kids, you can do it. Sheldon Adelson did it. He left something like close to $8 billion to his heirs. And he did it by setting up these things called GRATs, grantor retained annuity trusts, which are just these, I won't get into the details because it's really arcane, but if you put a low valued asset that's bound to grow into one of these trusts, everything that's left over at the end of the trust term, which is 2 years or 3 years or however much you set it to, goes to your heirs. And a lot of that's tax-free. It all depends on the interest rates and so forth. But if you have a volatile stock and you put a volatile stock in there and you do a bunch of two-year grats, you basically cannot lose. If the stock goes down, you end up still having the shares. If it goes up, your heirs get all the benefit from it. And so that's what Sheldon Adelson did. And that's what Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg and Dustin Moskovitz of Facebook did. They put Facebook shares that were worth almost nothing pre-IPO into these trusts for their beneficiaries. And then a couple years later, when the stock has gone crazy, the value that goes to their heirs tax-free is just astounding. So that's, Gary Cohn, who was one of Trump's advisors and Goldman Sachs guy, he once said reportedly that only morons pay the estate tax. And all the wealth advisors probably went, yeah, only morons pay the estate tax.
So let me ask you a question. But here's my question on that. So when you say they don't pay taxes on it, so, okay, I take these stocks. When I sell a stock, regardless, I got to pay a tax, whether it goes to my kids or not. Someone's got to pay a tax for that stock, correct? For the sale,
right?
So, but you're saying that they're avoiding paying the estate tax, but the tax on top of, so if I, Mazurbani, went and started buying buildings and all of a sudden all the buildings grew and all of a sudden I'm worth $100 million. And then I die and I go, but I've already paid, before I die, I sell all my buildings and I pay whatever taxes I got to pay on that income. So whatever that is, I don't know, 20%, 30%, boom. Now my 100 million is 80 million, let's just say. Now I say to my kids, guys, I'm leaving you $80 million. I've already paid the taxes on this, guys. Don't worry about it. Not quite that right, Maz. You got to pay an estate tax because you're giving it to the kids. You know, there's a little, whatever, 20 million of that between my wife and I can be taken off. So off of $60 million, we still got to pay a tax, correct?
Right.
Okay. So I guess the, the question becomes two-part question. If I've already paid the taxes on those, and I'm again taking the side of the wealthy person here, if I already paid the tax on those, why should I have to pay another tax when I'm giving it to my kids, number one? Number two, Mike, why is it every time somebody leaves their kids money, 9 times out of 10, these kids go nuts and they like, why don't, it feels like what you said, it causes more trouble. It seems like there's, I mean, obviously I'm sure there's a lot of people who get the money and end up doing good and maybe they're hardworking, but it feels like that's the stereotype we have from like the kids in Succession, for example, who might feel, you know, like they are owed something and they're just going to abuse it or they're going to end up fighting with each other. It feels like it happens a lot. Why?
Money brings up all kinds of tensions and emotions in families. And, you know, people are jealous of, you know, there's a company and this child was allowed to be a big part of running the company. And this other sibling is jealous of it and they want their fair share, but this guy has been running the company. The company is worth more because, you know, it gets, you know, all these fights. People fight over a vacation home when the parents die, whether to keep it or sell it. People, you know, there's trustees of these trusts who get to make fiduciary decisions. And the kids are always suing the trustees because they don't like, oh, you're giving this money to this sibling because they want to start a nonprofit. Well, what about me? You know, you get all these petty jealousies and so on, and it rips apart a lot of families.
It's almost like when you have nothing.
Yeah.
It's almost like when you have nothing to fight over, the feelings are there. There's just nothing to fight over.
But to be fair, Maz, it's one of those situations where the loud minority makes it seem like it happens all the time. For every Paris Hilton, there's also a Nikki Hilton. Nothing happens. Like, there's a lot of these kids that just become generationally wealthy, and we don't remember this, you know? So Julia Louis-Dreyfus is not a problem. You're not looking at her, by the way, billionaire. You're not looking at her like, oh my gosh, she's crazy. She's out in these streets. You don't hear about, you know, Kevin Gates or Jimmy Gates or whatever Bill Gates' kids are. We don't even know his kids' names because we don't hear about them. We hear about the you know, the cokehead, crazy one, blah, blah, blah. But for the most part, this is a way that capitalism works. It is extremely generational, which is why people of color have always been, and especially leaders, have been speaking about how that generational wealth makes it very unfair. It gives an unfair advantage. It makes it almost impossible for someone of color to exceed. When you look at that Forbes list, not a lot of Black people on that list. You have to be Jay-Z or Oprah or just Walton family member.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about taxes, one thing to think about taxes and budgets is they are moral documents, right? They are how a society expresses what it feels is moral and ethical. And you got a bunch of kids who never did anything in their life and they're just handed $100 million. You know, is that fair to the people who had nothing, right? So, I mean, a society can and does have these redistributive taxes. And I think it's plenty fair. If you talk to like this guy, Richard Watts, who's this conciliary for billionaire families that I talked to a bunch for the book, you know, he tries to get people to not give too much to their kids. He says, give them $5 million and call it quits. You know, he was talking to people with hundreds of billions of dollars because it almost wealth destroyed his family. Mm. I will get into that. It's in the book. But it destroys a lot of families. I mean, there are some people who are fine. You know, some people can handle a huge inheritance and do good things and so forth. But is it fair for them to have that in the first place? Because they literally did nothing but be born.
Guys, I hope you're enjoying this episode. Once again, I'm so excited to have HelloFresh as our sponsor on Back to School with Maz Jobrani. These guys are amazing. They sent me a box of the food. They send you basically the ingredients, and then you prepare the food in 20 to 30 minutes tops. You don't have to go to the grocery store. You don't gotta go spend a bunch of time prepping and cutting. And it's all done. It's ready to go. They get it to you. My wife and my daughter
decided to do it themselves. They did the bolognese. They sent us a pasta bolognese. My wife said it was delicious. My daughter had a great time preparing it because there's very little prep. They basically send you all the stuff. It's pre-chosen. It's healthy choices. You got breakfast, lunch, dinner. It's multiple choices. And I highly recommend it. And because you listen to my podcast, you're going to get it for free. That's right. All you got to do, you go to HelloFresh.com/12school. The number 12, the word school. HelloFresh.com/12school. Enter the promo code 12school. They'll send you 12 free meals. Try it out. You'll see. You can prepare food in like 20 minutes to 30 minutes and you eat and you feed everybody, by the way. It's not just you. You feed everybody. So check them out. We did it. We're loving it. It's a great way to skip having to go stand in line at the grocery store. It's a great way to not be stressed out about cooking. Who's got time now to do all that stuff? These guys prepare it for you. All you got to do is do the final step, which is the cooking, and you can make it fun. So go to HelloFresh.com/12school. Enter the promo code 12school. Tell Uncle Maz what you think. It's free, including the shipping.
You say in the book that Americans spend more money on lottery tickets than on books.
Yeah.
What do you have a lottery
ticket? Hopefully that will change.
Hopefully that will change. If you buy this book, Jackpot, if instead of buying a lottery ticket, it'll make you a happier person. That's really what we're out for. We're trying to make you happier. All right.
That's right.
Did you run into any lottery ticket winners who regretted it or had trouble, you know, their life fell apart afterwards?
Well, that's what we always hear about, right? I actually could not get any lottery winners directly.
Because they're probably already dead from all the lines of coke and strippers.
Okay, so I have a couple lottery stories. I mean, one is another super wealthy guy that I interviewed. He was part of a big hedge fund or private equity fund. He bought a house on Lake Tahoe right next to Larry Ellison's giant thing. And on the other side, this young guy buys a house, probably like $4 million, $5 million house. And he gets to talking to the guy. It turns out he had won a lottery jackpot. He was kind of just a regular Joe. And he was in his 20s. He was always up there partying with his friends, but he had nothing going on in his life except this money. And so one day the rich guy gets to his house and there's the coroner's truck in the neighbor's driveway. He goes over there, the guy had killed himself.
Oh my God.
I mean, it can really mess with people's psychology and emotions and feelings of self-worth. Lottery winners have it really tough because they've never had money. Most of them have never had money before. Same thing happens to like new athletes, like good athletes who have come up in poor circumstances, and all of a sudden they have just millions of dollars pouring. It's like, what do I do with this? I've been going crazy, you know? They go crazy. And but they have a job to do and they're pretty focused on it. So they're all right. But they tend to, you know, overspend, and a lot of them get financial trouble
because they actually started in the NBA and NFL and MLB have specific finance teaching courses for their rookies now, mandatory courses that rookies have to go through because so many athletes went through the same fiduciary problems that Michael was talking about.
I talked to a business manager for, you know, athletes that are making $2 million a month. And he said that he thought those seminars were kind of a joke. He said, the effective part is when they bring in former
athletes. Other athletes, exactly.
Yeah, who said, you don't want to do what I did. That's the people they listen to. They don't listen to these white guys in suits, you know?
100%.
He thinks these guys are all in there just to make a sale anyway and to get clients.
Well, I think that's part of the problem is the idea of knowing how to manage or live. Just because you have $1 million doesn't mean you need to go buy this crazy car, right? And also, my father was a wealthy, successful businessman from Iran. He brought a lot of money from Iran to America. And recently, I was talking to the kid of one of my dad's friends who was also wealthy at the time. My dad ended up losing a lot of his money in bad real estate investments. But when he first came at the revolution, they had all this money and they weren't really doing anything because they weren't, you know, they didn't come here. They weren't doctors. They weren't, you know, they didn't have a vocation they could go to. So they'd be trying to invest some of the money, but a lot of their time was spent just hanging out. And I think at a certain point, after you hang out a month or two or three, it's kind of like during the pandemic, after you've like been drinking, you know, on a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you're like, what now? You start losing perspective. So I think probably that's a big part of it, is not having perspective. These rich kids who just get handed the money, who don't have a calling, who don't have a passion, and then they get caught up in, what am I just, I mean, if money is the root motivation in your life, trouble's around the corner.
I think that's totally correct. But even if you have a motivation, even if you have a vocation, it can still mess with you. Like one of my characters was part of this crew at Netscape in the early days. They called them the Mozillionaires because Netscape was the first IPO that really went crazy, sort of started the whole first dot-com boom. And so it's a bunch of, you know, 25 to 35 year olds sitting around. They're coders, they're geeks. They never had any money. Nobody knew you could make all this money off tech. They were getting decent salaries. You know, things were growing, but there hadn't been any of these crazy IPOs. And then all of a sudden they had been given stock options. And this guy, he's like, oh, they just offered me this and I just took it. I didn't negotiate. Because nobody knew that the stock options were going to be worth anything, right? They all thought, maybe I'll go out to dinner on the proceeds or whatever. But all of a sudden, they're multimillionaires, all of them. 300 people overnight, multimillionaires, the secretary. And what he said is that there was this sort of, he called it a shared trauma. It's like existential crisis. All these young guys, and of course, the company was eventually dwindled out. And you have all these guys with tens of millions of dollars and they didn't know what to do with it. And they didn't know how to manage it or how to handle it. And they'd never had money before. And he called it an existential crisis because people would sort of go off and say, oh, you know, I really want to be a photographer. And they'd wander around for 3 years and come back. So you have to really, it makes you have to really find your new purpose in life. If work was your purpose and you stopped doing it.
Well, there you have it, Mike. The point is, don't become a billionaire. Read Jackpot. Do not become a billionaire. And find your purpose in life. This is actually, it's a great read because of these characters that you go out and you research. How long did it take you to write the book?
A couple of years.
I
thought I could do it in a year, and I was hopelessly naive.
The irony is you're going to make $1 billion on book sales, and then we're going to have you back on and find out what it's like to be a billionaire.
Michael doesn't want to be a billionaire. Maz, would you be a billionaire?
Oh, gosh. I don't. It's definitely not in my desire to. It's not. I've never woken up and been like, I need to be a billionaire. Matter of fact, I used to do a joke about, this was my joke. Bruno Mars has that song. I want to be a billionaire so friggin' bad. Buy up all the things I never had. And my joke was, I was like, billionaire? I go, when did that happen? I go, there used to be a time when people just want to be a millionaire. I go, I bet you there's a guy who's been working his ass off to become a millionaire. He's feeling good. He calls his mom. Mom, I'm finally a millionaire. Turns on the radio. They go, I want to be a billionaire. He's like, shit. I got to keep going. So I don't want to get caught up in that, Tehran. So I'll say no to billionaire as well.
Good for you. Good for you. I'll take both your billions.
Exactly. I knew you would.
Both your billions, not sharing, like giving the kids the whole nine.
I mean, if you even bought a house in the Bay Area like 20 years ago, you're definitely a millionaire.
Yeah.
That's very true.
$1 million, as I put in the book, it won't even get you into the top 10%.
Yeah, it won't even get you in. And the concept is, we always think of, oh, well, generational wealth. If there's two people, there's a guy who works hard, smart, creates something and becomes wealthy. And when I say wealthy, I'm talking about 100 million plus. There's this one guy, that's how he made it. And then there's another guy whose great grandfather was rich and the grandfather was rich and then father was rich. And then he becomes $100 millionaire. Who do you respect more, Maz?
Of course, the guy who worked.
Wrong. The guy whose family gave it to him. How do you know? Because that's the guy that gets in the clubs. That's why they make fun of new money. That's how important generational wealth is. They don't allow the new guy in. The new guy has to have kids that have kids that has kids before he can get in. It's that generational wealth that the wealthy actually respect.
And that's what the problem. And that's where the jealousies happen. And then one guy goes, you're new, I'm old, and this and that. Now you got miserable rich people.
Oh, poor babies.
And
poor.
That's why Mike has a book to write, because there's miserable rich people out there, people. That's the beauty of this. Listen, if you don't like rich people, this is the book for you. Read about how miserable rich people are.
No, but the book, I've got to say, I treat rich people with compassion. You know, I talk to them about their problems. And of course, world's smallest violin, right? But they're real problems and they're real pains. They're human beings. And most of them are not, you know, they're not the Koch brothers. They're not people who are like trying to change policy to make themselves richer. They're just sort of going about their lives like the rest of us.
They're not the Emmanuels.
But they're also not standing up and fighting inequality that they know exists, or sort of turning the other cheek to it.
Yeah. Well, that's why it was interesting, because like you said, you talk to people, like you were talking about the guy, the Mozillionaire, who basically invested something like 45,000 or 25, I forget what the number was. And then all of a sudden he goes on his honeymoon, and then Netscape stock starts going up. And
that was Amazon. Yeah.
Oh, Amazon. That's right. The guy invested like 40 grand or something in Amazon. He was just, there you go, Jeff. And then he goes on his honeymoon, and all of a sudden he's worth like $40 million. And he's like, what just happened? So the stories are really interesting, and you're right. You do deal with it with compassion, and it is something to really look into, because as you said, I think it's going to require more people from the 1% or 0.001%, whatever that is, to look at themselves and go, wait a minute, this doesn't feel right. So hopefully there's a future. What do you think of this stimulus bill? Is that a step in the right direction?
It is the biggest sort of sea change I've seen in my lifetime as far as combating inequality, like giving money to families with children. That's huge as far as bringing people out of poverty. I mean, there's all of these provisions that are coming out right now. You know, Biden is really the only president who he just has a team of people who care about this and are trying to level the playing field. But the trouble is, you've got, you know, half the political, you know, establishment on the other side, and they're going to block you at every turn. But fortunately, the public is behind a lot of this stuff. That Biden's really popular right now. And, you know, I think most Americans are just sort of sick of the plutocracy. Mm.
Amen, my friend.
What's the most interesting fact in your book? The most interesting fact that you found out from your book? I'm doing this.
Well, you know, that's a crazy question, because there's so much in here. I want to tell you an interesting fact about Matt Gaetz, though, since we were talking about him before.
Yeah.
He grew up in the same house that Jim Carrey's Truman Show character was in.
Are you serious?
Literally the same house. One of my colleagues revealed that in a piece.
Holy, and the irony that now his life is on under the magnifying glass in such a way. Oh, Matt Gaetz. I don't know. It reminds me of the line in Lethal Weapon 2 when Joe Pesci keeps his character name is Leo Gaetz. He goes, you get it? What Leo wants, Leo Gaetz. So Matt Gaetz, what Matt had coming, Matt Gaetz. He got it. So let's go now to a section we're going to call Back to School with Michael Mechanic. Five quick questions. Just hit us back as fast as you can on these. Who is the worst rich person in history?
Oh, God. It's got to be the guy with the lead smelter. I'm sorry, that's not a quick answer question.
Wouldn't you put John Paul Getty in there? He let them cut off the kid's ear.
Okay, yeah, I'll do that.
All right, we'll take him. All right. Should we buy Bitcoin?
Not now. You should have bought it when it was 300.
Shit. What, it's like 50,000 now or something?
Might have hit 60.
I have a friend whose friend put his entire life savings into it when it was 300. He's probably worth $100 million now.
Oh, God.
But missed that boat.
Missed it again. Who's your favorite rich person?
I would have to say it's either Chuck Feeney or Zel Kravinsky, both of whom I write about. Chuck Feeney made and gave away almost $9 billion.
Whoa.
And he kept only $2 million for him and his wife in retirement. And he did most of it without telling anyone. He kind of kept it under wraps. They call him the James Bond of philanthropy. The other guy, so Zell Kravinsky, is a real estate investor, lives in Pennsylvania. He famously gave away his real estate fortune, was like $45 million. He gave it all away. And then he thought that wasn't enough. So he went undercover to a hospital in North Philadelphia, gave away his kidney because he wanted to be a person of color who got it. So he had to go to this hospital that catered to mostly Black clientele. So he thought he would level the playing field by giving away his kidney to someone who needed it and save a life.
Wow. You should have had me on speed dial. I'd be like, Zev, it's a bit much, buddy. Take it easy. We get it. You want to give away everything you own.
Yeah.
Do you have any...
The funny thing is I went to meet with him and turns out he's richer now than he ever was.
Yeah,
he made it all back.
Yeah, he sold it all back. He sold the kidney, he doubled the kidney price, and you know it's a whole other book. Do you have any Republican friends and do they like you?
You know, I used to have a bunch of Republican friends, not so many now, because there aren't so many in the Bay Area, actually. They liked me. I liked the kind of Republicans that you could have a real civil debate with and talk about ideas, because not all conservative ideas are bad. It's just the lying and the dishonesty. This what the Republican Party's become is awful, and I it's hard to be friends with people who can't tell the truth.
Yeah, you don't want to be hanging out with Marjorie Taylor Greene, is what you're saying.
Oh, good God.
Mike, your last question. What's the most money you've ever won?
$10.
$10? That's it?
Yeah, that was in the lottery. I got three numbers.
You didn't play like blackjack and win $50 or a slot machine?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So let's see. No, actually, I won a couple hundred bucks a couple weeks ago playing poker with my friends.
See, that's what true. I'm talking about.
Okay. You're on your way.
On your way.
Jackpot.
Jackpot. Let's now go to the segment we call What Did You Learn? Tehran, what did you learn on this episode?
I learned that money does not buy happiness. But it turns out being broke doesn't either. Sorry about it. I'm going to be rich. All right. Also, got to find Martha. So if you have her Instagram.
I learned that I should have bought Bitcoin a long time ago. I'm just going to be kicking myself the rest of the day. Thanks, Mike, for bringing that up.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. Well, listen, I want to thank you, Michael Mechanic, for being on Back to School with Maz Jobrani. The book is called Jackpot, How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All. It's available everywhere. Books are found. And I want you guys to give it a read. It's very interesting. And you can also find Michael on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle, Michael?
It's just Michael Mechanic, like the guy who fixes your car.
Very easy. He'll fix your car and he'll fix your financial problems by telling you, you don't need money. Find happiness.
Oh, I also have a website, readjackpot.com.
Readjackpot.com. Guys, it's actually a great book. It's a great read. We're going into the summer season soon. So get your book, sit by the pool, get your read on. Michael Mechanic, thank you for being on Back to School with Maz Jobrani.
So cool to be here. Take care.
Thanks, buddy.
Back to school. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Back to School with Maz Jobrani. We hope you're enjoying it. We hope you're having fun. And we hope you're learning something. So make sure to let your friends know. Share it on iTunes. Share the clips from YouTube. Just get it out there. However you're listening, let your friends know to tune in to Back to School with Maz Jobrani.
Back to school. Yeah.